Good morning, Zbyszek Zalinski here, standing in for Marian. Now, to the sounds of the week. We had unhappy commuters in the capital.
There's a lot of people out in suits, walking, they had to get taxis.
And unhappy, striking Dublin bus drivers.
We want to go to work, but we give our union a strong mandate for industrial election because of the implement cuts coming in.
There was bad news and good news about Super Quinn.
Super Quinn is no more, but the sausage survives.
We also had...
It's not within the rules. You're not supposed to rugby tackle someone from behind.
Sorry.
It was a total disgrace, and I'll tell you something else about it.
Excuse me, Joe.
I mean, nobody has stood up for Tunis more during the 2000s than I have in this...
Tunis! Apologies about that. Joe Brawley really needs to get something off his chest. And we'll let him do that later. This week didn't start well for the commuters in Dublin, as the bus drivers went on strike last Sunday. The dispute was over unilateral implementation by management of Labour Court recommendations aimed at generating savings of almost 12 million euro. Valerie Cox talked to the drivers protesting outside one of the depots in the capital for the Today programme.
We've nothing to give. We hate to see the public think us, they're our bread and butter. But unfortunately, we live in the community and we have to bring these people in. And we, like I said, our families and friends are waiting for buses and no buses today. We want to go to work, but we give our union a strong mandate for industrial action because of the implement cuts coming in. We cannot afford these things. We have to survive as well. People are saying, I know there's a lot of people at home who haven't got work, unfortunately, but it's not our fault. We are trying to work, but we cannot go in under terms and conditions what's being changed and will be changed again in our opinion. We do a job. Unfortunately, all the stuff that happens in the job, like people do think it's an easy job. Fair enough, it might be under the impression, but it's easy, but it is hard sometimes. And we feel that we get an adequate pay for it, but they're trying to deduct that pay for them.
The strike continued into the working week, affecting commuters relying on buses to get to work or do their shopping. There are about 400,000 journeys made on Dublin buses each working day.
I had to walk down to Baggot Street to collect my medicine this morning and my legs. There's a lot of people out in suits, walking. They had to get buses, they had to get taxis. People that can't afford to get taxis, everyone walking.
So you're having a tough time?
Yeah.
And you have to do this every day?
Yeah, yesterday and today I had to do.
And where were you walking from?
I'm walking from Clonskea Road all the way to Baggot Street and back.
Where are you coming from?
Booterstown.
And you're walking to where?
Dawson Street.
Now, would you normally do that?
No, I'm normally on a 46A or a 145. So, a little bit put out, but not too bad. Like,
so how long is it taking you?
A bit over an hour.
And will you walk home again?
I'll run home. We'll all be fit this week.
Commuters in Dublin on the Today programme on Tuesday morning. Minister for Transport, Leo Varadkar, spoke to Jonathan Clinch on News at One on Tuesday. He explained why the government was not going to intervene in the dispute.
Ultimately, what this is an industrial relations dispute between management and unions. There was a time in the past where ministers would intervene personally and directly in disputes like this and solve the problem with taxpayers' money. That's not the way Ireland works anymore. Ireland's never going to work like that again. The taxpayer just doesn't have more to give. So what is required here is an intervention either from the Labour Court or the LRC, but that will only be done when the conditions are right, when those bodies are satisfied that there is sufficient common ground to bring about an agreement. There is little point in resuming talks if those talks are not going to end the strike. That's the key thing.
Buses came back onto the streets of Dublin on Wednesday morning to the relief of thousands of commuters, business owners and tourists. After all-night talks between union officials and the management, the Labour Court proposed a new deal helping to find savings in the company. Dublin bus workers will vote over the coming week on whether to accept the proposals or not. Wednesday brought bad news about jobs in the retail sector. Marks & Spencer announced closure of 4 stores in Ireland with 180 jobs lost. We also learned that a venerable Irish brand, Super Quinn, was to be no more. Their owners, Musgrave, decided to merge it with their other supermarket chain, Supervalue. Fergal Quinn is the man behind Super Quinn and he started it all the way back in 1960. At the beginning, the name was supposed to be different.
We were going to call it Super Q, but the shops were very busy at the time, and I only felt that people would say, I no wonder they call it Super Q. Look, you have to queue up at the checkout for so long.
The serious fallout of this rebranding is that 102 members of staff at Super Quinn headquarters in Lucan are facing redundancy. The less serious concern was to do with one of its iconic super products.
Well, if you're of the East Coast, and Dublin in particular, you would probably this morning enjoy the various odes that have been written to the Super Quinn sausage and be relieved to hear that the pork product would be retained despite the imminent wiping of the Super Quinn name from our grocery shopping landscape.
OK, at least there is a little bit of good news there. Perhaps not for my waist, but honestly, who can resist a sausage on a Sunday morning? Fergal Quinn got the sausage idea on a visit to the land of Wurst, Germany.
Saw this very busy supermarket that was built side by side with a sausage factory. There was a glass barrier between the two. And people queued up at the butchery counter to buy their sausages that had just been baked or just been made a few minutes earlier. And you couldn't shop in that shop on your own because somebody would steal your sausages from your trolley when you were going down the detergent aisle. But I remember going to lunch that day with the American supermarkets, one of whom has 1,000 stores and the other 200 and the other 500 or something. And I said, I can't wait to get back. I can't wait to get back because I'm going to put a sausage plant in each of our shops. And Morris and Northside would be great and John and Sutton and Jim and Finglas. And one of the Americans who had 80 shops or 100 of them, he said, no, that's of no interest to me. You see, Fergal, we're too big to do that. But because I knew Morris and I knew John and I knew Jim, I knew the people who'd be able to do it. And that's when we went out and then came up with the sausage. And Pat Kelly, who was our manager in Northside at the time, said, I think I could make a success of this. And he came back to me and said, when we experimented with sausage, we said we could have the tastiest sausage, or we could have the healthiest sausage, or we could have the cheapest sausage, which we would go for. And we decided to go for taste.
The tasty recipe has remained a closely guarded secret over the years, while the Super Quinn sausage has acquired legions of devoted fans, not least amongst the staff of RTÉ Radio 1.
Are you partial to a sausage?
What do you think?
Important issue. Yes.
Well, it's an important issue.
It is. It's a very, very
to
important
me, anyway.
Issue. Very, very important.
Do you ever have sausage and jam?
Sausage and jam? No, I haven't tried that one, should I?
It's a classic sweet and sour thing.
And what kind of jam? Any particular preference?
One of the red ones, preferably.
Strawberry, raspberry. Mm. Raspberry, strawberry jam and sausage.
Before you mock me, try it.
I will, Des. I promise. Des Cahill there, confessing all to Miles Dungan on the Today programme. We heard at the very beginning of the programme from Joe Brolly. He was very exercised after watching Tyrone beat Ulster champions Monaghan by 2 points in the All-Ireland Senior Football Quarterfinals on Saturday. He was rather critical of man of the match Sean Kavanagh's challenge on Conor McManus late in the game.
It's not within the rules. You're not supposed to rugby tackle someone from behind. It was a total disgrace, and I'll tell you something else about it. I mean, nobody has stood up for Tyrone more during the 2000s than I have in this studio, when they were getting all sorts of abuse from you and from you. But I'll tell you this, I'll not be standing up for that. That's an absolute disgrace. And the casual way that it's done, last week they dragged down the young Meath fellow when he was through from it. Drag him down. That's how you do it. Wallace only got the goal because he escaped the rugby tackle. Today, Sean Kavanagh, who is a brilliant footballer, what he did there tonight was a total and absolute obscenity. Hold on, let me finish the point. McManus gets the ball. He decides, I can break through here. I can score a goal. He shows a sense of adventure. He beats the first man. He's through. What happens? He's just dragged down to the ground. And I'll tell you what, the black card's only the start of an absolutely urgent process that's required. There is no sport, no other sport apart from Gaelic games where that is permitted. It's an absolute disgrace.
Joe Brolly's comments started a heated debate within the GAA community, both here and abroad. Áine Lawler spoke to Philip O'Connor, an ardent GAA man who monitors the games from his home in Stockholm.
Well, I have to say, I was watching the game last night here in my home in Stockholm, and I was on Twitter at the same time as we tend to do these days. And as soon as Joe made his remarks after the game, it sort of exploded, the whole thing, in Ireland and abroad. As you know, there's a pretty strong GAA community abroad now. There's 80 clubs abroad and that kind of thing. And it all just went mad. And it was kind of split down the middle. There was a lot of people saying that what Kavanagh did was wrong and maybe he should have been sent off. But there was also an awful lot of people defending him, saying that what he did is part and parcel of the game now. And I kind of reacted to that because, to me, it might be part and parcel of the game now, but it doesn't have any place in it whatsoever, in my opinion.
And do you think black cards will sort all that out?
No, I don't think so, because I think that this is bigger than Joe Brolly and it's bigger than Sean Kavanagh. It's actually bigger than Gaelic Games itself. I wrote a piece last night of a blog called arrowmanandstockholm.com, and I wrote a piece and I said that this says more about the Irish people than we probably care to think about.
In what sense?
Because it's very, very acceptable to bend the rules as far as possible and in a lot of cases break them as long as we get the outcome we desire.
There's nothing like sport to stir up passion and awaken our desire to win, whether it's football, hurling, or the humble tug of war.
The Barn and Lake Hill, are you ready?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Let's make sure you get a good foot and a good drop, you know. Turn over your mean now. Turn your mean over now, let's. Turn them over from one to anchor now. From one to anchor now. What's the drop now? Long and tight now. Keep walking there tight now. Keep it on now. Keep it on, keep it up, keep it up, keep it up. Your job is to keep it up a small bit there, tight. Tight on the button there now, tight on now. Turning this up now, the for all, for every man, or for the button off, can surrender. Yeah, no, keep it on now, they're tight now. Keep squeezing, and that's the one, keep squeezing, that's the one, that's the one. That's the one, now you pick it off the ground and drive it. Push it, tight now. And take back the hands. Come on, get off the ground and push on the wall. Get off and get put two hands in it.
I told you there is a lot of passion in sport, whatever sport and whatever the level. Gus O'Loughlin lives in the beautiful village of Corraffin in County Clare, and he's the coach of the Boran Tug of War team. Ronan Kelly recorded him for Curious Ear. Gus also spoke to Joe Duffy on Wednesday.
What is the attraction of Tug of War?
Well, it's mainly sporty. There's a character to it. It's something that it's a sport. It's a sport that's who those people that don't play hurling or football or soccer or rugby or whatever. It's a sport for those that are that see that maybe there is an outlet in their life outside of a social outlet in their life, and it's a family day out because when we go pulling, most of our families come with me. My wife and our daughters come with me on the day out.
Come on, the banner. Come on, the Boran. Gus O'Loughlin educating Joe Duffy on the merits of tug of war. Last weekend was the busiest weekend for the gathering. 207 events took place across the country. Anya Kavanagh is the spokeswoman for the gathering, and on Monday she told Miles Dungan about all kinds of visitors to our shores.
There was a kind of a quirky one in County Louth in Cornamucklid. There was a donkey derby, and they even had a donkey coming from Arizona, so they've really embraced the gathering concept in inviting people and animals from overseas.
Everybody's welcome, I say. The more, the merrier. They're not really talkative donkeys, though, as Marty Morrissey experienced on Countrywide last Saturday. He was chatting to Dominic Geraghty, who has a mobile farm. Dominic brought Nelson, the donkey.
And Nelson, I don't think will talk to us because when he arrived here, he was hee-hawing at an almighty rate. But hello, Nelson. No, he won't talk to me.
He might in a few minutes now when he gets his breakfast.
He's a little bit hungry.
He's like myself. He likes to breakfast.
Where are those super quinn sausages when you need them? Later on in the programme, Marty was talking to grow-it-yourself enthusiast Terry Byrne.
Well, lots of people listening this morning, Terry, might be inspired by what they're hearing and try to plant a few seeds. What advice now would you give?
Well, the site first, the soil, and then the seed. All the essence. Oh, there's the dog.
Our animals are finally speaking to us. I think that was Nelson. He has been fed.
Finally, the sound of a well-fed donkey. That was Marty Morrissey and, of course, Nelson the donkey on Countrywide last weekend.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
podcast today's programme at rte.ie/radioplayer. Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
The plan to hold a Republican parade in Castle Derrick in County Tyrone caused controversy. The Tyrone Volunteers Day, planned for tomorrow, will commemorate the deaths of two IRA men who were blown up by a bomb they had been transporting 40 years ago. Miles Dongan spoke to local Democratic Unionist MLA Tom Buchanan and to Pat Doherty, Sinn Féin MP for West Tyrone. He began by asking Tom Buchanan about Castle Derrick during the Troubles.
Castle Derrick, as you have said, was one of the most bombed towns. And in 1 year, there were over five car bombs in Castle Derrick in that particular year. Castle Derrick has suffered immensely as a result of that. And we have seen 29 people in the Castle Derrick area alone that has been murdered as a result of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Now, these were murders, and we have to be very clear about this. These were murders that were planned, were premeditated, and were carried out by Republicans. We have to be clear on that. These were premeditated, planned murders that were carried out in Castle Derrick, and now today we have, we have a number of families who are victims now in all of this. And obviously with the forthcoming planned parade, it is opening up the wounds again. It is causing severe hurt and pain that is unnecessary. But apparently Sinn Féin, who are organising this parade to glorify those who were coming in to cause further pain and destruction and mayhem, are turning a blind eye to that pain that exists in Castle Derrick.
Miles was then joined by Pat Doherty. He asked him about the context of the parade.
But I want to put a question to Pat Doherty specifically about this parade. I mean, you talk about the numerous orange parades that take place in Castle Derrick. Now, a Republican parade is one thing, but context is everything. And as far as local unionists are concerned, this is particularly provocative. Perhaps certain things are best forgotten. Certain things are best not commemorated. And car bombings are at the top of that list. Why choose specifically to commemorate two people who attempted to bomb and failed to bomb Castle Derrick in 1973.
There was an armed conflict, and the armed conflict had many aspects to it.
But I mean, Pat, we're not talking here about members of a flying column who took on the black and tans. We're talking about people who were trying to plant a car bomb.
How do you know what they did or did not take on? What we are doing is commemorating and honouring the memory of IRA volunteers who sought and their right to take on the British presence in Ireland and to bring about Irish freedom. That's the Republican tradition. That's the Republican history. We're not seeking to glorify anything. We're seeking to commemorate. And it is the unionist politicians, particularly the DUP and the UUP, and to some extent the TUV, who have hyped this up.
But you're commemorating, as I say, I repeat, you're not commemorating a flying column who took on the black and tans. You're commemorating two people who were attempting to bomb civilian targets.
We're actually commemorating all the volunteers of Tyrone who died in the conflict. It happens to be the 40th anniversary of two volunteers who died when their own car bomb exploded.
Democratic Unionist MLA Tom Buchanan and Sinn Féin's MP for West Tyrone Pat Doherty exchanging views on the Today programme on Friday morning. Life is very difficult for parents caring for their disabled children. Moira Skelly called Liveline on Wednesday to share her troubles.
Moira Skelly is there as well. Moira, your daughter Kyria is in Stewart as well.
Yeah.
She graduated in June. She's 18.
She did indeed. Mm-hmm.
And is it
Kyria? Sorry.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, Kyria has severe intellectual disabilities. She has autism. Should I say she has cerebral palsy, intractable epilepsy, and a mental age of 2-year-old. She's also doubly incontinent and in nappies. She's crying every morning. She keeps saying to me, "Bus, bus." I said, "No, darling, not today. No bus today." The child is so depressed, and she's crying all the time. She just doesn't understand that there's no school, and I don't know if she's ever going to get a service again. And I don't know how I will cope as a parent if that happens.
There are 11 students with severe disabilities who cannot continue with their education in the Stewart's Hospital due to lack of funding. Martina Kelly's son, Graham is one of them.
I have two children with special needs, not just the one. My son Graham, I know Eva and I know Myra there as well. My son Graham is in exactly the same position. And it's so hard having them at home. He's bored stiff. He's crying. He wants to know where his friends are. Why can't he go to school? Why can't he be with them? I can't explain to him because he won't understand, Joe. He's in a wheelchair full time. Again, I'm like Myra. I can't lift him on my own. My husband's in work. I rely on my 16-year-old son to help me with the two of them. Because Erica is 13 and she's got the same condition as Graham. Both of them are in a wheelchair. I'm devastated for him because he's such a social little guy. He doesn't have many words. He's got the biggest smile you could ever see, Joe. Mm. He's just beautiful and I'm devastated for him.
Parents of Children with Disabilities talking to Joe Duffy on Wednesday. Ask FM is a controversial website based in Latvia which allows users to post comments anonymously. It's been linked to the suicides of Irish schoolgirls Kira Pugsley from Leitrim and Erin Gallagher from Donegal. There have been renewed calls for the website to be monitored more closely after the death by suicide of an English schoolgirl, Hannah Smith. Della Kilroy spoke to teenagers and asked them about what happens on the website.
People get abuse on it, terrible abuse on it. It's just people being nosy, really, to find out stuff because it's anonymous.
What type of questions would you ask or get asked?
It's just things about your personal life. Like, it's just you sign up and then you have a button beside it saying ask anonymously or not anonymously, and then they just ask you a question.
What do you know about Ask FM?
I'm not on it, but I know a lot of my friends are. And I know a lot of them ended theirs because they were getting hate messages from people.
So you girls use Ask FM?
Yeah.
What age are you?
I'm 16.
And what do you use it for?
Just like made a page because everyone was on it. I used to get horrible questions, but now I don't anymore because I like let it go really. Don't care about it.
What type of questions would you get?
Just like, oh, kill yourself, you're ugly. And there's like loads of people that be bullied on it and all. It's horrible.
Did you report it when someone said that?
No, I just let them do it and they just kept doing it until I just stopped really answering them.
It's used for just basically bullying. Like, it's just your friends from school like asking you real personal questions, and then like sometimes they don't even ask you questions, they just like tell you what they think of you.
Yeah, no, I used to know like loads of people use because they'll be on the news feed all the time and like there'd be links on it and everything like ask me a question and like people pressurising people like ask me a question and then like you'd go on to it and then you'd see like loads of questions or whatever and like some would be very bad and some would be inappropriately bad and everything like dead relatives and everything like it'd be terrible like yeah.
Do you use Ask FM?
Yeah, sometimes.
What would you use it for?
Just when I'm bored. I don't know, do you know the way like people like people slag and all on it? I think like, do you know, if you get slagged on, I find that funny. Yeah, if my mate was on it, like, it's like, but like I tell him it was me, like if
one of our friends has red hair and he always slags him about it.
But sometimes people go too far with it.
Go hang yourself and all that stuff like.
A number of prominent companies decided to pull their advertising from the website. A move which was welcomed by anti-bullying campaigners. Dr. Mona Moore is the founder and the coordinator of the Anti-Bullying Research and Resource Unit at Trinity College. She spoke to Rachel English on yesterday's Morning Ireland.
Every organisation has a duty of care and there's, you know, the health and safety measures. So again, this could in some ways be applied to these sort of social networking sites. But having said that, this is where education then does come in, because I think young people need to understand and have a greater understanding of, say, cyberbullying so that they do not personalise what is, in a sense, what they are subjected to. They should know that they should suffer no shame. And we know in Ireland, for example, there's a pitiful percentage of children who will report it to their parents. Why? Pitiful percentage of children will report it to teachers. Why? It's a shame.
As you say that, it's terribly sad, isn't it? That for a young person, that if something unkind or abusive or threatening is written about them online, that they will feel scared to go to their parents or in some way nervous about going to their parents.
That's because of societal attitudes tends to put the blame on the victim. We should be educating society so that the blame squarely lies, you know, on the shoulders of the abusers. I mean, they are, let's face it, they are the most cowardly, mean-spirited, unempathic individuals who set out willfully to hurt somebody. And that is where young teenagers and children should understand that they should not carry the shame. The shame should lie with the bullies.
Dr. Mona Moore there. If you're affected by bullying, or if you know of somebody who is experiencing it, don't be afraid to speak up. Talk to a friend, talk to your parents, but don't stay silent. And you can also visit the website of the Anti-Bullying Centre at abc.tcd.ie. Now, you might have thought that the golden days of showbands are long gone, but you'd be mistaken. Apparently, there's a growing appetite for a bit of jiving and hucklebucking up and down the country. And it's all way more professional these days.
It's much more professional now. Everything is totally organised. They actually pay tax. You know, and when
the bouncers the bands
and probably the bouncers didn't pay much tax. It wasn't, I think tax was a three-letter word that we didn't really understand.
Yeah,
like sex.
You mean tax didn't happen in Ireland, was it?
Matt Britton from the Donegal Democrats speaking to George Lee on The Business last Saturday. The showbands might be paying taxes, but are the dance floors as bouncy as they used to be?
At that time, in the story, which was probably one of the leading ballrooms in the country, well run by the O'Connell family, and it's unfortunate TP can't be here today, it had a sprung floor underneath the floor. You could get down underneath it for a height of about 3 foot. Were Volkswagen springs, which give it an additional springs.
I don't believe it.
So, oh, yeah, the whole floor would move. And, of course, we moved with it. But then they had a floor walker there called Whitey Albride. And when the dances got slow, he wouldn't let you dance close. Tap on the shoulder, him and his monkey suit. And the second thing then, because when the story would get very full, he wouldn't let you jive so they could let more people in.
Volkswagen Springs. Trust the Germans to give us a bit of a bounce. Brian McAniff spilling the beans on the secrets buried beneath the floor of the Astoria Ballroom in Bundoran. Matt Britton had a different version of events, though.
I think Brian might be telling a bit of fibs about the springs. And sort of my belief that in the story is that they had old remold tyres in there, which give the same effect as good spring floors.
There were genuine Volkswagen springs, if you want to check with TP O'Connell, because I actually bought the story of Ballroom and got underneath it.
Did you keep the springs?
The springs were there, yes.
We can argue whether it was the Volkswagen springs or the tyres which gave the ballrooms a bounce, but one thing cannot be disputed. There was no show like a Joe show. Anya Lawler travelled to Mullingar to talk all things Joe Dolan. She spoke to his nephew, Adrian, and discovered the prosaic truth behind the famous white suit.
He loved the white suit, and I mean, it came from a practical element, because Joe used to sweat a lot on stage, and he did an RT programme one time and wore a blue suit. And unfortunately, at the end of the programme, he had marks under his arms, marks in his trousers. So they looked at it after that it wasn't practical doing a show. So Ben, my dad, decided, well, you know, Joe, I'll tell you what, if we put you in white, we won't see the stains. So that's where it came from.
That's the suit sorted. What about the shoes?
How high were those platforms?
I don't know. It could be 4 or 5 inches. But he stayed at our house around about that time. And I remember him coming home from gigs, but when he took off his shoes at night time, there wasn't a pleasant smell or anything. So I remember getting those shoes and putting them out on my windowsill, because he'd stay in my room some of the time.
Entertainment is not as glamorous as it looks.
Wow! Me, oh my, you make me sigh, you're such a good looking woman. When people stop and people stare, you know it fills my heart with pride. You watch their eyes. So surprised to think you've fallen out of heaven. And if you listen to what they're talking about who's walking about with an angel at his side.
Now, there must be something in the water in Mullingar that brings out the singing talent in young men there. First, we had Joe Dolan, and now we have...
Tell me, girl, if every time we...
One Direction there with Niall Horan on singing duties. And Niall is, of course, from Mullingar. We heard that song last week on Drive Time with Mary Wilson.
A lovely and unusual interlude here on Drive Time. Well, that was One Direction featuring, of course, Neil Horan, our own. And they're set to become the first billion-dollar boy band. Steve Futterman joins me from Los Angeles. How have they managed it? They were the runners-up on The X Factor back in 2010. How have they got such wealth in such a short time, Steve?
A couple things. First of all, there's some talent there, obviously. And then there's marketing. Marketing, and they fit the type of marketing that seems to work. The girls love them. That's very important in all this.
The baby girls.
That's right. That's right. Who spend lots of money, who get their parents to spend lots of money. And it's just all working. It's one of those things that at the moment, and this can be a short-lived life for boy bands, as we know, but it's all working right now. And yes, I guess technically they could become the first billion-dollar band. One of the publications is estimating they will have around $500 million in total concert sales, around $300 million in record gross sales. The movie This Is Us will get them around $150 million. DVD sales, they say $15 million. And then the other stuff, like their cosmetic line, like their fragrance line, that will earn them maybe around $67 million. Add it all up, comes to around $1 billion. If it's correct, we will find out. But they're very wealthy. They're doing quite well.
One Direction aftershave? What happened to A Splash of Old Spice? Boyzone were the original Irish boy band. Tremendously successful, their history was marked by the sudden death of Stephen Gately in 2009. Maxi looked back on the way too short life of Stephen in the documentary On the Streets Where He Lived. Keith Duffy remembers the moments after Stephen's death.
There was no questions asked. It was, we're going to Mallorca. For whatever, I don't really know why. You know, we just had to be there. I suppose it was to be with Stephen. That's where he was, you know. Mm. So we went to the airport, and it's bizarre because we don't go to the airport anymore as a group. We always go individually because regardless of what you think of Boyzone, when you get a group of lads together, they just you know, they've confidence within themselves, few drinks on board, and they just decide to kind of throw abuse at you. And over the years, you get used to taking it, you know. Now, not everybody's like that. It's usually when they're in a group. When guys are on their own, they're very nice. But when they're in a group, and we just couldn't handle a guy's giving us abuse on this particular morning, you know. And we're walking through the airport, and X-ray, the guys at X-ray were so nice to us. They were just unbelievably kind to us to help us get through. I had a hood up, I think, and a pair of glass on, and Shane had a baseball cap, and I think Mikey had a cap on as well. But we're minding our own business, and the three of us are just walking to get a flight to Gatwick and then wait there for Roland to get there. But we're passing by a group of lads, a stag deal, must have been 16 or 18 of them. And not like 10 out of 10 times these guys are going to like throw abuse at us, you know. And it was just really weird because Shane looked at me as much to say, if these guys go, let's just go, you know. He said, he didn't say anything, but that's, you just knew the way we felt. We were so all over the place.
Vulnerable,
angry, upset, annoyed.
Don't annoy
me
today.
Just stay away, yeah. Because yes, yeah, there's 16 of you and there's three of us, but yeah, believe but, me, yeah, you'll come out the
worst. Superhuman.
And we knew, you know, it would come to my head, the police will understand the position we're in. They'll let us get our flight. It was every single one of them just nodded at us, and if the odd one just said, sorry for your trouble. And that made it even more, that made it worse. That just choked us completely, you know. And the newer part of the airport had just been built, and we found a quiet corner up there. And Shane said, look, I'll go and get a few beers. And Mikey said, I'll go and get some food. So I sat at the table, probably in a little bit worse emotionally than the other boys were at that moment in time. And I was just gathering my thoughts. And the other boys were kind of strength for me, you know, especially Shane, because he's a strong guy emotionally. He'll have his moment when he's on his own, but, you know, he can hold a brave face. And he came back to the table floored with his few beers, and I thought, what's up, man, like, what's happened, you know. And he barely could tell me, he could barely talk. He just said, they wouldn't charge me. You know. And then Mikey came back with two full breakfasts that, you know, we were just going to share between us, and he was the same, they wouldn't charge me a penny, you know. I took an extra sugar. You know.
So in,
but it was just amazing, the support that we got,
yeah,
was phenomenal.
Love.
No matter what they tell us, no matter what they do, no matter what they teach us, what we believe is true. No matter what they call us, however they
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson. Podcast today's programme at rte.ie/radioplayer. Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
Tony Benn is a British Labour politician who has been an MP, a cabinet minister and an advocate for peace. Miriam O'Callaghan spoke to him on Wednesday morning and we heard a more private aspect of Tony Benn. He told Miriam about meeting his wife, Caroline.
Caroline was an American student who came over to Oxford in England for a summer course in 1948. And I met her on August the 2nd, 1948. I was introduced to her by an American friend who said, "You must meet her, you'll like her." And I had tea with her on August the 2nd. And on August the 9th, 9 days later, being rather shy, I proposed to her. I thought if I don't, I'll never see her again. And she accepted. And, she lived at that time in Cincinnati, Ohio. And she came over the following year, 1949, and we got married and we had 50 years together. And then she died. But she had an enormous influence on my life.
Tony proposed only a couple of days after meeting Caroline for the first time. He wondered where he should ask the question.
I went to meet her and took her out in Oxford in the evening, and I thought, where shall I propose? And so we wandered around, and I saw this bench in front of a church, and it was empty, so we went and sat there. That was where I proposed. And then I later, when we were married, I wrote to Oxford Church and I told them the story and said, "Can I buy that bench?" And they said yes. So for £10, I bought that beautiful bench, and it was delivered in London, and used to sit on it in the garden in my little house we lived in. And then Caroline and I decided to install it in front of her grave, so where her ashes are now, in the garden of a house in Essex.
It's such a romantic story. Their relationship was very close to the very end.
She used to say, I used to talk to her a lot about the fact she was dying. It's a very difficult thing to do with somebody you love very much, to have the end of the relationship. And she said, "Well, I see death as an adventure. And I'm quite excited by that." And so she approached death with great courage. She wasn't frightened by death. And I feel that was I learned from her how to die.
Saoirse Ronan is one of our most talented and successful actresses. She might be only 19, but she has already played some very challenging and complex parts. Nothing, however, is more challenging for a teenager than kissing in front of their parents.
The Host, yeah, The Host, which was the film you did in 2013, yeah. You had a little kiss with
Max. A few kisses.
Well, a few big kisses,
had
I suppose.
A few big kisses.
With Max Irons. And yeah. Your dad was on the set, and when it came to time for the kiss, you said, "Turn away, Dad."
You know what it was? There was a few kisses throughout the shoot with two guys, and it wasn't my decision, but I think it was the very last kiss that we had to do, and it was on the second last day or something, and we were all in a desert in New Mexico, and Dad was there, and I just went over and I said, "Listen, Dad, you're my dad, and I don't want you watching this, even though it's, you know, just a kiss, but I don't want you watching it." So basically we were over, I mean, we were maybe like, you know, 50 meters away from him or something. And when I saw him, I said, "Just turn around there." And he turned around, and he, you know, they're in the desert, so there's no wall or anything. So he's just like looking out at the desert while we're doing our stuff. But he was very good about it. And I mean, he didn't want to watch it either. Yeah. So we were all happy about that, I think.
She's a true pro. Saoirse was only 14 when she was nominated for an Oscar for her role in Atonement in 2008. She was excited, quite naturally, but she was also...
I was knackered because I had just flown in from New Zealand where I was doing the Lovely Bones. And we had already been shooting it for about 5 months at that stage because we shot a bit of it in Pennsylvania in the States. So there was a lot going on, you know, and it was an amazing time. I mean, I'd love to go back again, even just as a kind of fly on the wall to really appreciate it, because I was so young when I went and there was so much going on and it was amazing, but it's a lot to take in, and it's, you know, the biggest film event that you'll ever go to. So but it was great. I mean, you're on the red carpet for about 2.5 hours, and I, you know, I was 13, didn't wear heels or anything like that, and suddenly I was putting these little Jimmy Choo shoes and my feet were killing me, and we got inside and everyone was starving. So but I remember Glenn Hansard won that year. So and I missed it. I'm painting it out to be awful, but it was a great night. But I had gone out to the loo, and it just so happened that I had to go to the loo because it's about a 3 hour long ceremony. And I went out to the loo, and while I was out there, my dad comes running out during the commercial break and says, Glenn's just after winning. And we missed the speech. We missed the brilliant speech that him and Marquetta made. But I saw it later on YouTube, so it was fine. Just watched it later on YouTube.
Saoirse Ronan there, interviewed in public by Sean Rocks at the Galway Film Fla. You can listen back to the full interview by going to the website of Arena at rte.ie/radio1. The Academy Awards are, of course, all about the movies and the Gunas. Don O'Neill is from Ballyhike in County Kerry, but living and working as a fashion designer in New York. He's got an impressive resume, and he's just made a very powerful friend, Oprah Winfrey.
I was kind of excited that she was in New York. I thought, oh my God, wouldn't it be great if we could actually get to fit it on her, and then I could meet her. Mm. I said a quick prayer to Mom when we sent off the dress, and I thought, Mom, please be great if I could meet Oprah. That was Tuesday. Wednesday, we heard nothing. Thursday, we heard nothing. Friday, I'm like, okay, we've heard nothing. The event is on Monday night, so obviously something mustn't have worked out, or she didn't care for the dress. And then on Monday morning, I'm on my way to work, and it's 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm heading down into the subway, and I get a text from Melissa, who does our PR. Don, oh my God, Oprah's assistant just emailed me. Can we be at their hotel at 9 a.m. this morning, and can we alter the dress by 3 o'clock? I'm like, oh my God, this is surreal. And here I was dressed like crap, hair not done. I'm like, I can't meet Oprah looking like this. Had to do a U-turn, tore back home, glammed up, tore into work. I was in such a rush, I forgot to do my hair, so I had to actually do my hair in the office and gel it up and get it all glammed. And by 10 to 9, we were sitting in the lobby of the hotel, and Kelly, her assistant, came down for us and whisked us up to the presidential suite. And Oprah herself opened the door and greeted us with that big smile that everybody knows and a big warm handshake. And she said, oh my God, Dan, I'm so happy you came. I'm sorry this is so last minute. I don't do this to people. And she was so sweet and so chatty. And I'm like, you look amazing in the dress. And she's like, I know, but it's Forrest's movie, and I really don't want to upstage him. And I'm like, Oprah, if you came in your bathrobe, you'd upstage him on the red carpet, which I thought was funny.
Oprah wore Don's dress to the premiere of The Butler in New York on Monday, and she looked spectacular. Don had a photo taken with Oprah, which appeared on the front page of the Irish Independent during the week. He wrote to her to share the good news.
And I sent her an email yesterday. Oh my God, Oprah, Ireland loves you. We're on the front page of the Independent together. And I got back an email because I said, I was so lucky. This is amazing. And the reply was, it's not luck. It's only opportunity meeting preparedness. Wow. So happy for you. Kisses.
We're happy for you too, Don. Keep up the good work. Don spoke to Miriam O'Callaghan on Thursday. Now, earlier on this week, we heard from a fellow broadcaster from North Norfolk Digital, one Mr. Alan Partridge.
Hello, my name's Alan Partridge. Let me start by shocking you. I actually like Ireland, and I like Irish people. I'd like to pass on my condolences, first of all, because I've been informed that the Celtic Tiger was shot dead recently. But I know that the Irish will come through with great aplomb. They've spread their love throughout the world with the Irish diaspora, which is like a sort of positive disease. It's not just hot air. The director of Alpha Papa is actually an Irish man who's Irish. His name is Declan Lowney, and he's someone you'd be very proud of.
Miriam O'Callaghan got to speak to the Wexford man, Declan, on Tuesday. She asked him whether it was difficult to transfer Alan's character from the small screen onto the big screen.
Steve and the guys are very, very protective of Alan and staying, you know, staying absolutely true to his roots. So leaving him in Norwich, letting the action happen in the radio station, creating a scenario where Alan just literally wanders into something that's much bigger than him, but it's going on around him, and he's not the cause of it necessarily. So that was why I think it's worked so well, because we haven't compromised, if you like, the integrity of Partridge's world. You know, it's still pure Partridge in there, but it's just that we put him into an unusual circumstance.
Now, you're doing well if you can sing in key, and you're doing even better if you can sing in harmony. Well, that's not a problem for Emily, Jessica and Camilla Staveley-Taylor of The Staves. They are three young sisters from Watford in the UK, and boy are their harmonies sweet. They performed live for The John Murray Show with Miriam on Thursday. That's it from me for this week. Until next Saturday morning, I'll leave you with Facing West from The Staves.
Silver, and I don't think that I can do this anymore.